Welcome to the Center for Investment Excellence, a production of J.P. Morgan Asset Management. The Center for Investment Excellence is an audio podcast that provides educational insights across asset classes and investment themes. I'm very excited for today's episode. We have Michael Semblist, the Chairman of Investment Strategy in Asset and Wealth Management, joining us. So, Michael, thank you for coming on today.
Good to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about alternatives, actually a lot about alternatives during our conversation today. But you know, to start, I wanted, Michael, to get your sense of the broad direction of the economy as you see it this year. You know, we had an inflation print that reminded everybody that disinflation doesn't happen in a straight line. We've seen growth prove to be more resilient than expected. And I personally think that there's still some room for Fed cuts this year, but probably not as many as what markets are currently pricing in. So how are you thinking about the macro environment in 2024?
Well, we're on track for a market first. You know, if you're passionate about markets, it would be kind of remarkable to think about the inverted yield curve being wrong.
Yep.
Starting last August, we started to say, you know what? The yield curve is inverted, but in the past, when the yield curve was inverted, it was inverted with short-term rates that were very high. This time it wasn't. It was inverted with corporate cash flow, financial balance being negative. This time it's not. And so there are some things that are different this time around. And right now, you know, so it looks like we may get through this without a recession. Look, growth is still running somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5%. A lot of the last thing I'd pay a lot of attention to is inflation data from in January. Historically, about half of that gets reversed in February. And so, you know, I still think we published an inflation monitor.
Yeah, the inflation.
It's online, yes. And it's got inflation in, you know, labor markets, real estate, supply chains, PCE, CPI. It's got the whole thing. And if you look at that in aggregate, it looks like the disinflation is reasonably well entrenched, and I agree the Fed should be able to cut once or twice this year.
Yep. And so I think, you know, all eyes will obviously be on that inflation data in particular going forward, but we're seeing a lot of the same things in multi-asset solutions and continue to look for a soft landing this year,
right,
and inflation getting back down towards target.
Other than the benefit of there not being a recession, you know, because recessions are bad, it would also, I think, be useful for markets to kind of understand that a population sample of 6 or 7 is not that big.
Right.
And that people should stop over extrapolating 8 events that took place over the course of 72 years.
Yep. I would very much agree with
but
that.
We'll see. In fairness, though, when recessions did happen,
yep,
after inverted yield curves, they generally happened at least 6 or 7 quarters after the first Fed hike.
Right.
That's where we are now.
Yep.
So the jury is not out. You know, I think, you know, if we haven't had a recession by the end of this year, that'll be pretty notable.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, a lot of people over the past, you know, 18 months, as we've seen, have been calling for recessions. And I want to move the conversation over to alternatives because one of the things that people were talking about was, well, oftentimes from a vintage year perspective, you know, a recession is the best time to be committing capital to a private equity fund. We've seen that in the data over time. And so I wanted to get a sense from you, one, how you think about measuring performance in private equity. And then I will move on to 2, talking a little bit about some of the more recent vintages and whether or not the gains are actually there. But let's start with the performance question.
Okay. So I spend a lot of time on performance measurement. Private equity, believe it or not, is easier at times than venture, which is easier than hedge funds.
Yep.
So we need to talk about those all independently.
Yep.
Private equity performance measurement historically was difficult because the data aggregator data was terrible, right? Reporting by private equity managers to Venture Associates or Greenwich or one of the data aggregators was voluntary and incomplete.
Yep.
And so starting a few years ago, Steve Kaplan at the University of Chicago and some other people convinced Burgess, which is a custodian, to gather all the LP data on anonymize it, and then make that research available publicly. And so we don't have any survivorship bias questions anymore or incomplete data reporting anymore about private equity with the benefit of this LP custodial-based data. So now that we have that, we can ask ourselves the question, how are they doing? you know, we can debate about benchmarks,
yep.
S&P, leveraged S&P, S&P small cap or mid cap to reflect the market cap sizes of a lot of buyout companies. In general, using a mid cap or a large cap index, the private equity industry looks like it's doing okay.
Yep.
As of 3-4 years ago, it was treading water versus public markets. Now it looks a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And the state-of-the-art measurement that one would use, whether it's direct alpha or a PME, or it's a performance measurement ratio, which is essentially an IRR measure versus the IRR of the markets, looks something on the order of like 3% a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that enough
yeah.
for liquidity purposes? That's a hard question to answer in the abstract. If you told me that you were looking at a pension plan or an endowment that had a 5 or 10% allocation to private equity, that's enough.
Yep.
That's enough compensation. If we roll back the clock and look at some of the Ivy League endowments mm-hmm. that had 40 or 50% in private equity before 2008, that's not enough. So in my mind, the premium that you'd need to earn is somewhat a reflection of what your allocation happens to be, because you're, you know, the more you own, the more you need to earn a decent premium to compensate you for that illiquidity. So I think it's very hard to put a specific number on it. The other thing that's really interesting is, let's stop the clock at, let's say, 2017.
Yep.
Because after 2017, the vintage years haven't had enough time to kind of put money to work and have early distributions.
Yep.
So if we stop the clock and we look at like the 2015, 16, and 17 vintages in both private equity and venture, the excess returns look okay.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the vast majority of that, either MOI or IRR in those funds, has yet to be monetized.
Right.
And so when we wrote a piece last December that looked at an alternatives update, that's the issue, which is the numbers look great, but I had to ask myself, why didn't these managers monetize
right.
more of their investments when the going was good
times were
and
good.
The SPAC market was open
yeah.
and, you know, before rates rose and liquidity was plentiful?
So let's stick with private equity
yeah.
and buyout for a second. And I think you make a very good point. And this is one of the things that's always come up in conversations with institutions, you know, well, they have these paper gains and they're not realized gains. And how do we think about the valuation process, you know, beneath the surface? We're in this world of seemingly higher rates. And we've seen that there are implications for private equity, lower leverage share of the multiple, in theory, right, more dispersion, more winners and losers. How are you thinking about private equity in a world of higher rates? And I would actually love to hear, particularly in light of all of the new business formation that we've seen over the past couple of years. I mean, is that a greater opportunity set? And do you think private equity firms will be able to take advantage of it? Or do you think that a higher cost of capital could get in the way?
You know, we're in, I think it's going to take time for a lot of money to be put to work.
Yeah.
Capital is not scarce yet.
Mm-hmm.
So as an asset allocator, for an institutional investor, it's not particularly like an extremely distressed period when you'd expect excess returns. I see no reason why somebody wouldn't just continue their normal asset allocation approach, whether it's a private equity or anything else. But the deal flow is down, but the multiples are still high. We're not seeing multiples falling meaningfully below 10x
right.
on a sustained basis.
Right.
And so the multiples are still high. Less deals are getting done.
Yep.
And, you know, the credit market, it's a weird credit market, right? Because spreads are tight.
Yep.
Where the high yield spreads are close to the tightest since they've been since the financial crisis,
yep.
but the volumes aren't there.
Exactly.
So it's almost like the same thing you're seeing in the real estate market,
yep.
where transaction volumes in commercial real estate are down like 90%.
Yep.
So you don't really know where the market is.
Right.
You don't know where the clearing prices are. So I think the private equity community is going to have a challenging time putting money to work. The deals are going to have to be the really good looking deals.
Yep.
And a lot of the liquidation and monetization process is going to be really stretched out
yep.
over a longer period of time.
Yeah. And I think you make a really important point about, you know, only the good deals are getting done. That's why the multiples haven't come in, right?
Because
the multiples are reflective of the deals that are happening in the market. Turning to venture capital. So venture generally had a pretty difficult 2022. You look at the secondary market, you have seen some fairly significant drawdowns, but I would take your point that
there's more to go.
Yeah.
So a couple months, let's see, last month, that was in January, I went out to San Francisco and JP Morgan, as everybody may know, acquired First Republic Bank and have a lot of new clients from Silicon Valley Bank. So the commercial bank arranged a meeting with some of the top VCs to talk to them about, hey, you know, welcome to JP Morgan. How can we service you better? And I was there as part of that discussion. And, you know, after we talked about all the relationship issues, we talked about the markets a little bit. And this is fascinating. For anybody that's spent time around venture capitalists, wouldn't surprise you. In the same breath, they would say, Michael, yeah, there's a lot of dead money from those 2021 and 2020 vintages that still hasn't been written off.
Yep.
And at the same time, the current vintages that we're investing now are going to be the best performing vintages in the history of venture. And, you know, God bless them. It takes an enormous amount of courage and conviction to invest in these kind of business models. Obviously, their view of the transformative nature of biomedicine, artificial intelligence, large language models, open source, closed source, all this stuff is enormous.
Yep.
And they think that GPT-4 launch is equivalent to the launch of Netscape or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take 18 to 24 months before we have any idea.
Right.
You know, a great benchmark for me is this. It's not a particularly public one. But JP Morgan, the firm, has 300 large language AI model projects going on, all of which are designed to prevent mistakes, errors and omissions, cut costs, improve returns, et cetera. And I'm interested to see how those 300 projects turn out.
Yeah.
How many are just get discontinued because they didn't do any benefit? Yeah. And after we narrow it down, how much compute space do we really need?
Yep.
Right. How much outsourcing do we really need? How much are we willing to really pay? Can we use our own coders and use free open source models from Meta instead of having to have these expensive third party relationships with Google or OpenAI?
Yep.
So I think that's going to be really interesting and important for the VC community over the next couple of years, because there's a lot of optimism on the space right now.
Yeah, I completely agree. My brother actually works for a VC firm out in California, and he said like the flow of AI-related stuff coming through the door is just, it's unbelievable, right? Everybody's doing something in AI. The point he made to me over the weekend was, when we look at these businesses, it's not about whether or not they use AI, it's about what the AI technology does, right? And I think that that's the point you're making about what we're doing here at JP Morgan, like which of these actually move the needle and, you know, from an investment perspective, help generate alpha.
I mean, here's an example that, you know, when I first mention it, you won't think it's the same, but just think about it. What were we all talking about 4 years ago? Blockchain.
Yep.
Everyone's talking about the blockchain.
Yep.
The blockchain had these magical properties. An ex-colleagues of ours who went into that business were hired by the Australian Stock Exchange to convert the entire thing to a blockchain environment. And after $200 or $300 million of investment, it got scrapped because it didn't work the way it was supposed to work.
Right.
So all I'm saying is that a lot of times these productivity enhancing projects look different after the fact. I happen to think that the large language model revolution has more legs to it, obviously, than the blockchain did. But, you know, it will have to, given the margins and the valuations that are currently sustaining some of these big companies right now. And military demand may be a big piece of it for this whole ecosystem, because the entire military is kind of being redesigned for – You keep reading about $50,000 weapon systems destroying tens of millions of dollars of equipment.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that has to do with these kind of tools.
Yep. Well, that's certainly going to be a conversation that we're going to be having for the foreseeable future. You mentioned, you know, things not working, and I want to pivot and talk about something that hasn't really worked until the past few years, and that's hedge funds. You know, the yeah. hedge fund performance we saw post 2008 and
it was very, pretty bad.
Very, very bad. We can leave it at that. So what are you thinking?
I was really surprised.
Yeah.
Because when I sat down last fall to do our hedge fund analysis, I was based on what you read in the press and in Barron's, Financial Times, and what I see internally and what I hear from large institutional clients, I was expecting the numbers to look pretty grim.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
Exactly.
They did not look grim at all. Now, let's talk about this, because remember how I mentioned up front, you know, hedge fund performance measurements even harder.
Yeah.
You have to decide what your framework is. And for me, the only place you can really look is in a mean variance context and the, you know, the standard deviation of monthly returns
yep.
as a starting point. And then you develop some kind of mix of let's say the S&P and the Barclays Ag and some combination of that. So if you have a hedge, it's an ex post project. You own a hedge fund. Ex post, you look at the volatility.
Mm-hmm.
You then pick a stock bond mix that has a similar volatility. That's the fair benchmark.
Yep.
We ran, you know, thousands of portfolios, and the important part is we required each hedge fund portfolio to be diversified by style and have at least 15 funds.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're going to own 7 merger arb funds, like, I don't know what to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
But once you restrict yourself to say, okay, I'm going to own, you know, some diversification and at least 12 to 15 funds, and then you look at the correlation benefit and the volatility of those aggregated portfolios, the cluster, 80% of the cluster of them outperformed the you know that linear
yep.
stock bond combination. It's easier to understand this if you look at the piece from last December. So anybody here that wants to see that, your JP Morgan team can get it to you.
Yep.
The piece is called Paper Moon, and it came out in early December. But as soon as you see the chart, you'll immediately recognize that the performance cluster was left and above that mean variance line, which means it outperformed its risk-adjusted benchmarks.
Right.
We not only did we do it on HFRI, we also did Pivotal Path,
yep.
which is another source, right? Because now you do have to care about, you know, survivorship bias and reporting issues. And we used 2 or 3 different reporting databases, and we got, you know, very, very similar results, which is that the hedge funds, particularly for investors not subject to taxation, so they don't have to worry about short-term versus long-term gains, were better off in hedge funds than in some risk-adjusted proxy.
Yeah. I mean, what we've seen in our own research is that, you know, higher interest rates, higher volatility, lower correlation, elevated dispersion, all of these things should work in the favor of hedge fund performance, a lot of different types of hedge fund performance going forward. And so it feels like if we are going to be in this world where rates don't go back to zero and the Fed isn't, and other central banks aren't engaged in financial repression, hedge funds can be a source of return and diversification, right? Which is, we saw that twice during the pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, you have to... If you're going to invest in hedge funds, you have to be fair to them and fair to yourself.
Right.
And one of the things I remember from a few years ago, there was a very large institutional client
mm-hmm.
that terminated its hedge fund platform.
Yep.
And which was obviously within their rights to do. They did some analysis that we're out of hedge funds. I then spoke with them and I said, can you give me the criteria and the constraints
mm-hmm.
that you were putting on the person that worked for you
yep.
that constructed the portfolio? We then looked at those constraints, and they would have really restricted you to something that had a vol of like 2.5 to 4%. But they were using a benchmark that had a closer to a 7 to 8%
yep.
return in vol. So if you're going to constrict the way the portfolio is constructed, you need to have a benchmark that's commensurate with that. And so you have to just remember that as a hedge fund investor.
Yep. No, I think that that's all important stuff to keep in mind. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about real assets and then wrap up with a dialogue on private credit. But, you know, the elephant in the room, and it's come up a handful of times in our conversation here today, is commercial real estate. So you're seeing transaction volumes gradually begin
right.
to pick up. You're seeing a little bit of price discovery, but every meeting I walk into, they tell me they're going to turn the offices into apartments, and I just don't.
Well, I think you're the one that, what did you say, elephant in the room?
Yeah.
I'm thinking elephant's graveyard. yeah, I still think that markets and investors are underappreciating the exogenous shock associated with the average city having, let's say, a vacancy rate of, call it 25%, but pending vacancies of another 15.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, think about this. The average, a lot of companies now require people to work, they're working 5 days, but a lot of companies allow 3 days from home.
Yep.
But what are those days? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I travel around the United States a lot and see our clients. Monday and Friday is a ghost town.
Yep.
How long are those companies going to be willing to pay for 100% of the space for 60% of the people?
Right.
At some point, the CFO is going to say, we can still have everybody work 3 days, but we're going to spread them out over the week and we're going to give back 25% of the space.
Yep.
And this is not a tenable thing. In October last year, we did a big piece on 22 of the largest MSAs, the metropolitan areas, yep. comparing New York to other cities. And as part of that, we ran all the numbers and spoke to, you know, a lot of people in the industry about office to residential conversions. The bottom line is, I'd be surprised if more than 5 or 10% in any urban area
mm-hmm.
had the floor plate and the pricing that would be conducive to office to residential conversions. There's a handful of buildings for which it makes sense. And where the sellers may sell at a distressed enough price to make it happen, but that's not the solution to this.
Yeah,
the cities are going to have to figure out a way to attract businesses back into those downtown areas, and in that regard, who do you think is going to be faster and more creative, Raleigh or Boston, Charlotte or New York,
right?
Austin or San Francisco, right? So this is going to really stress out the big legacy high-tech cities because they're not going to be able to be as creative as the other cities are in trying to figure out what to do with all this underutilized office space.
Yeah, no, to your point, I had a three-seater on Metro North to myself this morning, you know, and that didn't used to be the case. And you don't see it on Mondays. You don't see it Fridays.
We'll see what happens. But I think this is going to play out over a really long period of time. And, cities like New York also have really difficult zoning restrictions.
Right.
It's almost impossible to rezone something. So the cities that are more nimble are the ones that are going to be able to get out of this mess faster. The only good thing is, even before the pandemic hit, the office share of the REIT market and of, NAREIT and Odyssey and those institutional benchmarks was coming down. So there's the average institutional portfolio owns a lot less office than it otherwise might have.
Yep, and that's actually something that we're going to touch on in a upcoming SIAG paper, how the public markets were almost a little bit ahead of this with
absolutely
being such a smaller share. Infrastructure. I talk to clients who love real estate. They used to love real estate before some of these problems. Uncorrelated streams of income, inflation protection, diversification, so on and so forth. They say, what else can you give me that kind of tastes and smells the same? Infrastructure has become the answer. But as you and I have discussed, there are a lot of nuances to infrastructure, particularly around benchmarking and the asset class itself.
It's almost impossible to benchmark.
Yeah.
I mean, just realistically speaking, it's really hard to kind of say what you almost the only benchmark I can think of is to compare one infrastructure manager to another.
Right.
Right. Because that's the best measure of the opportunity set. The deals are very idiosyncratic.
Yep.
And I would say more than any other asset class I've seen, the terms and conditions, you can invest in a natural gas plant, but did you make sure to put yourself in a position in the stack so that if there's curtailment, it doesn't affect you? What are the issues related to wind and solar being able to get preference on the grid? I mean, let's say you're doing something with shipping.
Mm-hmm.
How protected are you against, some kind of competing public sector project nearby? The specificities of how these projects are underwritten and structured is everything about their return.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to generalize. We have a really good infrastructure team. Paul and Matt do an amazing job. The best way to understand what they do is to talk to some of their PMs and have them walk you through a deal.
No, I mean, I think you make a lot of good points. And some of the things that they've mentioned to me over the past couple of years is, long-term visible cash flows of fixed rate debt and, you know, so the inflation pass through. And a lot of that has worked in favor of the asset class. But I think you make a very good point, which is that every manager is going to be different and every deal is going to be unique.
Right.
You could
and
be
no relying on consultants.
Right.
So,
exactly.
And what does that mean? Important point. Some of the worst deals historically have been things like toll roads.
Yeah.
Where what you're relying on is a consultant to come in and say, well, this is how much traffic you're going to get. And historically, consultants will look at it and say, a rational person would want to save both energy
yep.
and travel time. And therefore, they'd be willing to pay X to go on this toll road. People just don't. So consultants don't understand people real well, which is why they become consultants.
Right. Exactly.
Let's go to private credit.
And airports are different than utilities. And that's right. the final word on infrastructure. So private credit.
Right.
The darling of the institutional investment community.
Right.
I mean, they look at it like a silver bullet. But I say to myself, anytime you see the growth in the number of assets, the growth in the number of managers, some of the bespoke nature of the deals and flexibility, I mean, there have to be some bad apples amongst the bunch.
Oh, yeah.
So I would love to get your take. You know, one, what do underwriting standards look like today? And I think that question is particularly relevant as you've seen the banks make a push back into that space and try to grab some market share from private credit after they effectively disappeared at the end of 2022.
Yeah, this gets complicated because you've got a high yield market.
Yep.
You have a broadly syndicated loan market, and then you have the private credit market.
Right.
And all of those three things are different and function differently. My main focus is how does the broadly syndicated loan market, which is where most of the dollars have gone in over the last decade, compare to the private credit market, which has been more of a focus over the last, let's say, 2 years.
Yep.
The private credit portfolios tend to lend to riskier companies.
Mm-hmm.
Those portfolios tend to be more concentrated, so they're going to own less positions. If something goes wrong, it's a bigger impact on the fund. That said, it's night and day. I mean, imagine you're in a lawsuit and in one transaction, you're sitting across from a couple of law school students mm-hmm. that are still in law school.
Yep.
And the other one, you're kind of sitting across from two guys that have been in Cravath for 30 years. That's the difference between the broadly syndicated loan market and the private credit market. The private credit market ties these companies up in so many knots to protect themselves. They play offense and they play defense. And let me just tick through some of the things don't allow that are allowed in the broadly syndicated loan market. In the syndicated loan market, if there's a debt covenant where – and it's measured, let's say, in terms of interest coverage coverage of earnings, they don't have to use actual EBITDA. They can use projected EBITDA.
Right.
They can say, well, this is what we think we'll be earning in a couple of years, so let's do our leverage ratios based on that.
Yep.
You can't do that in private credit.
Correct.
In the loan market, if you sell a division, you don't necessarily have to use the proceeds to pay down the debt. You do in the private credit market.
Yep.
In the loan markets, you can dividend money to unrestricted parents and keep it out of the reach of creditors. Can't do that in the private credit market.
Right.
Insider lending. It doesn't mean what you think it is. Inside maturity lending, meaning can somebody come and effectively prime you by borrowing on a pari passu basis but with a shorter maturity?
Yep.
Happens all the time in the loan market. Can't do it in private credit. Right. So essentially, the private credit community are lending to riskier companies but trying to use structural, handcuffs to prevent these companies from doing anything malevolent to them.
Right.
And that's the big difference. The spreads are, let's say, 100 basis points higher maybe, So it's not a yield game.
Right.
It's all about taking on additional company risk in exchange for legal structure to kind of get out ASAP and prevent any losses. You need a real recession in order to have a real unfortunately, without a real recession, and 2020 didn't count because of all the PPP loans and the normal default channels didn't happen. You need a real recession to kind of benchmark whether this private credit approach is going to work better or worse than the loan market. I see so much poor underwriting in the loan market or non-underwriting that my preference was for the private credit market.
Yep.
Because I would rather have my money with people that are going to look at every single potential way that a financial sponsor, because that's who most of these loans are to, right? Yep. I mean, look, let's be clear. This is money to Apollo and Carlisle and KKR. Like, let's realize who's being lent to here.
Yes.
I think lenders would benefit by having as many protections as they possibly could.
Yep. And your point about lending to private equity was going to be the next point that I wanted to touch on. But I think you've made it clear that you're lending to seasoned players in this space.
I want an IP blocker. In other words, you can't sell the IP.
Right. Exactly.
And claim that that's an unrestricted asset or an unrelated asset. So one of the things we did in the piece last year is we looked at the actual incidence of these things from comparing across loan markets and private credit markets. And it's just night and day that the underwriting standards are much stricter in the private credit market. So if that's where you want to be and you want to be at, let's say, an 8 to 12% all-in yield net of fees, I think the private credit market's going to make more sense. Now, the real story here is not so much regional banks in or out. The big story is Basel.
Yeah.
That's the big one. But on paper, the proposed Basel changes would result in a 20 to 30% increase in capital requirements for the largest banks. I mean, that's where the opportunity set is for both leveraged loans and private credit. Because if that happens, right now, we're still in a comment period. We don't know how it's all going to turn out. But a lot of capital, I think, has mobilized with the expectation that those Basel changes are going to be pushed through. And if that's the case, it's not optional. You know, the big banks are going to have to change their capital strategies and lending strategies, and that's going to open up a lot of lending opportunity. Now, if I'm the Fed or the Treasury, it might make you feel good that you are protecting depositors better. But without question, you're going to be raising the cost of capital for the private sector by 100 to 200 basis points. So there's a price.
Yep.
So you can always take more steps to protect depositors more.
Right.
The mistake is believing that somehow that's free.
Right.
And there's a capital cost associated with that because banks tend to be the cheapest
form financing. Yeah.
So that's where we are, and we won't know until the end of the Basel process whether or not it's going to happen.
Yep. So maybe one final question, and then we'll wrap up there. If non-bank lenders do come in and fill that potential void left by Basel, what does that look like to you? How nervous does it make you?
There's a lot of things going on there at once, right? On the one hand, it's great for the people that are providing capital to those entities.
Right.
But it's bad for overall competitiveness. I mean, the United States is we're the world's reserve currency because of access to capital, cost of capital, and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Something like that would be effectively Europeanizing a large, more of the U.S. capital markets.
Yep.
And for anybody that's been investing in Europe over the last 20 years, the last thing you don't want to do is Europeanize anything.
Right.
So relative to the U.S.
Yes.
So I have mixed feelings about it. I understand too big to fail and wanting to kind of on the margin continue to improve, protections for depositors.
Yep.
But these Basel III proposals, I think, will have a pretty large effective cost if they're implemented.
Yep. Well, as we both know, there's no free lunch. So, Michael, thank you very much for joining me today, and hopefully I can have you back again soon.
All right. Thanks, David.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today on J.P. Morgan's Center for Investment Excellence. If you found our insights useful, you can find more episodes anywhere you listen to podcasts, on our website, and on our J.P. Morgan Asset Management YouTube channel.
This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.